Okay, we're recording. Hi, it's Ann Costello, and I'm with Salome Van Worden from Houston, Texas. She is going to give us a conversation and a little chat about early borderline personality disorder identification. She is a doctoral candidate in the clinical psychology at the University of Houston, and she also works under the membership of Dr. Carla Sharp, who a lot of us know, and an expert in borderline personality disorder in adolescence, and a co-founder, which is wonderful, of the Global Alliance for Prevention and Early Intervention for Borderline Personality Disorder. That's why we're here, the GAP. She has also been receiving clinical training in dialectical behavioral therapy at the DBT Center in Houston under the supervision of Dr. Karen Hall, who is also our NEA BPD boarder. She's on our board. It is March 18th, 2018, and Salome, you're on, and everybody else should be mute. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you so much, and just thank you to the NEABPD for organizing Family Connections and this whole leader series. So as Anne mentioned, I work under Dr. Carla Sharp, and in, I think, 2014, she, along with Perry Hoffman and Andrew Channon, founded the GAP initiative. And so a lot of the work that I'm going to be talking about is coming from research from people who are involved in the GAP initiative. And so I just want to kind of give them their recognition. So what I'm going to be talking about is borderline personality disorder in adolescence. And as part of this, I want to discuss some of the difficulties that I think our field has faced in recognizing BPD as a valid disorder in adolescents. Also, just apologize in advance that we're having some allergies, and so if I get a little bit congested, I apologize. So there have now been several studies that have been published that suggest that there is an underdiagnosis of BPD among teens. In fact, one study that was conducted with mental health professionals, only 37% of those who responded reported accepting the validity of a diagnosis of BPD in teens. Another study found that only 58% of professionals who were surveyed agreed that personality disorders could be diagnosed in adolescents. Another study found that about 23% of clinicians would use a personality disorder diagnosis with their teenage clients. So these studies are pretty notable. They suggest that there's a broad kind of misunderstanding among clinicians about BPD in adolescents. And the consequences of this are that teens who may actually meet diagnostic criteria for BPD won't receive the diagnosis from their clinicians. In fact, even one study that found that among clinicians who did actually believe in the validity of BPD in teens, of those, only 60% said that they would feed back the diagnosis to their clients. So there are several potential reasons why this underdiagnosis may be happening, and they kind of fall under two broad categories. The first being that the belief that giving a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder to a teen may be dangerous in some way. So in one study, a clinician commented that the label may have stigmatizing, marginalizing, and objectifying effects on young people. Another study, or another clinician in that study said that making the diagnosis could actually lead to a worsening of the difficulties. So altogether, these beliefs fall under the realm of that in some way, either a teenager receiving the diagnosis would be stigmatized, and that may actually exacerbate their symptoms that they're experiencing. The second category of beliefs is related to the idea that borderline personality disorder isn't actually valid during adolescence. And that can be reflected by a comment made by a clinician in one of these studies who said that the diagnosis is conceptually problematic because it omits crucial developmental factors and makes assumptions about the enduring nature of certain personality variables, and that would be considered developmentally naive in adolescent populations. So here, these beliefs kind of fall under the realm of the fact that the diagnosis of BPD isn't really meaningful in adolescence, and so they may age out of it, or it doesn't actually have any significance for outcomes. So hopefully through this conversation, I can help dispel these myths and provide some background as to how they kind of came about in the first place. So starting with the myth that giving a diagnosis of BPD may be harmful to teenagers, so this is based on beliefs that personality disorders are long-lasting, that they're treatment-resistant, and that they're unpopular to treat, and therefore it would be stigmatizing to label a teen with this diagnosis. So this myth is notable because it suggests that mental health professionals don't always acknowledge the empirical facts about the changeability of personality disorders. And, I mean, there is a background to why this myth pertains to personality disorders, because by definition, in our current DSM, personality disorders are characterized as being enduring and typically with a lifelong course. So that, you know, just under the definition, that they're seen as long-lasting and unremitting. Also, relative to cognitive behavioral therapy, which is kind of the go-to treatment for anxiety and depressive disorders, or behavioral therapy, the evidence-based treatments that we have now for BPD were developed a little bit more recently, just relative to these other treatments. And so their effectiveness may be just less widely known and recognized. So it's a little bit of an issue of dissemination and the relatively slower progress in this field relative to others. That being said, there's been just more and more research coming out that suggests that symptoms of BPD are actually much less persistent than has traditionally been believed. There have been kind of large clinical studies that show that somewhere between 85 to 93% of BPD patients will actually remit over a 10-year follow-up period. Here, remission is defined as no longer meeting a diagnostic criteria for BPD. So out of the 9 DSM criteria for BPD, 5 are required to meet the diagnosis, and so remission would be meeting 4 or fewer criteria.
Salome, I just want to stop you for a second. Someone texted me on my phone and said, can you go more slowly and louder?
Okay. Yes, no problem.
And make sure everybody's on mute. And would you like to take questions as we go or at the very end? We can have questions.
Well, definitely stop me if something, either if I went too fast and I kind of...
Okay, so if somebody has a question or a comment, they can come off the mute and talk to you. Okay, so slower and louder.
Okay.
Thank you.
No problem. I was talking about remission, and in this research, remission is defined as just no longer meeting criteria for BPD based on our DSM, which means that they would have to meet at most 4 criteria out of the 9 diagnostic criteria. So there are some problems with that conceptualization that I'll talk about a little bit later. But basically, what we find is that although the trajectory of remission is slower for people who have BPD compared to those in kind of comparison groups, such as people who are diagnosed with depression, it still suggests that the majority of BPD patients will improve. So one caveat to these studies is that there seems to be differences between different symptoms of BPD in terms of the stability. So studies have shown that the symptoms or criteria of BPD can be divided into those that are relatively fixed and those that are more intermittent. And so there might be some differences in terms of which features can be thought of as kind of the core symptoms of BPD that are more enduring versus those that may come and go, and that might be due to environmental stressors or a developmental stage. That being said, the studies that look at trajectory of borderline symptoms show that, in general, these symptoms tend to peak in mid-adolescence, and then they subsequently recede during the transition into adulthood and beyond. So more recent research has been focused on understanding what contributes to an individual's current level of borderline symptoms, and whether this is due to kind of an immutable borderline proneness or more transient influences that would cause these kind of more acute fluctuations in symptom presentation. So what, which features are more intermittent and which are fixed, and what that means kind of for the diagnosis, and especially in adolescence. However, it's a relatively newer line of inquiry, and there's still kind of more research that's needed in order to reach consensus. However, one study that was recently published by Christopher Conway looked at this question in a large community sample of adolescent girls in Pittsburgh, and they followed these girls over a 7-year period. It was a pretty high-risk sample that they recruited to participate. And they were interested in, again, parsing the BPD symptom expression into what they call trait versus occasion parts. So the trait part of this would be referring to this idea of some sort of enduring borderline proneness that speaks to the validity of BPD in adolescence. And so this is kind of this enduring factor that would be present over time. And this is compared to the occasion factor, which would be referring to the more transitory influences on BPD symptom expression. So, for example, occasion may refer to the causes of acute symptoms that are not actually manifested across the lifespan. So that could be like self-harm that may only happen in the context of like a conflictual relationship or during substance use, compared to maybe a more enduring identity disturbance. So this study by Conway found that about half of the variation in BPD symptoms that was measured at any given time point was attributable to more time-specific factors. And so about 50% of BPD symptom expression was subject to change across measurement occasions. And that's actually interesting because that rate is about the same as the rate that we see in depression during adolescence. And then the other half of variation in BPD symptoms is due to that more enduring trait factor or borderline proneness that represents genetic, biological, and more unremitting psychological and environmental conditions that would predispose somebody to borderline pathology. So this is really interesting because it suggests that kind of contrary to how we think about personality disorder as being this more lifelong, persistent disorder, that it actually is more similar to depression in terms of its relative stability over time. And so while BPD is valid and it is stable in some ways, it's also amenable to focused interventions that could address these more acute conditions, which produce symptom flare-ups that are not so consistent over time. And so, like I said, this research does need to be replicated and with different samples, but it is really a really interesting finding. And so along that line that, you know, we could, our kind of interventions that could address these more transitory aspects of BPD, there are increasing evidence that shows that we do have interventions that were developed specifically for BPD that are effective in improving prognosis. So for one, dialectical behavioral therapy, which you're all probably familiar with, has been studied probably the most extensively, and it does show that research does show that it can lead to improvements in borderline symptoms. Even some findings suggest that skills group alone can improve symptoms of anxiety and depression in teenagers. Also, mentalization-based treatment, which is probably maybe the second most studied evidence-based treatment in BPD, and it shares common features with cognitive analytic therapy. They both have shown that they lead to improvements in BPD symptoms. Also, there's transference-focused psychotherapy, which has been adapted for adolescents. And although that's never been tested in a randomized controlled trial, it has been shown to be effective in treating BPD. So in addition to these kind of full-blown treatments for BPD, there also have been kind of early interventions that have been adapted to intervene before BPD reaches kind of full diagnostic status. So these include Andrew Channon's program in Australia, and it's called HYPE, or Helping Young People Early, and it includes components of cognitive analytic therapy. Also STEPS, or Systems Training for Emotional Predictability or Problem Solving, also called ERT, or Emotion Regulation Treatment, and this was developed by Nancy Bloom, and it's a manualized group-based treatment similar to DBT, has been developed that can actually be used with youth who are not yet meeting full diagnostic criteria but are exhibiting some of the dysregulated emotion and interpersonal problems that we see in kind of sub-threshold BPD. So there's really no lack of evidence that BPD is actually not immutable during adolescence, and that too, we actually do have effective treatments that can be used with teens exhibiting BPD symptoms. In fact, it's actually really important that clinicians accurately diagnose adolescents such that they can be directed to those treatments. And I'm going to talk more about this idea of targeted treatment in a little bit. But next, I want to talk about the second category of beliefs I mentioned earlier regarding the fact that BPD is not valid during adolescence. So for one, there have been results of surveys suggesting that there are a certain number of mental health professionals who don't believe that our diagnostic manuals allow for BPD to be given as a diagnosis to people under the age of 18. However, that's untrue, as our current DSM, right, has no age limit for the disorder. Also, the current version of the International Classification of Diseases, which is primarily used in Europe and other countries, also states that a BPD diagnosis can be given prior to the age of 18, and that symptoms of BPD are actually already recognizably persistent, continuous, and not situation-dependent during adolescence. Other regional guidelines on mental disorders similarly allow this diagnosis before the age of 18. That includes guidelines in Germany, Australia, and Britain. So the hesitance regarding the validity of BPD in adolescence is partly due to the fact that adolescence in general is seen as a time of relative turmoil. So it's characterized by impulsivity, emotional and psychological instability, rapid mood swings, and increased vulnerability to breakdowns in adaptive behavior. Also, it's believed that personality itself doesn't fully develop until adulthood, and therefore a teenager who may be expressing a constellation of symptoms that looks like BPD may just age out of these problems as they mature. And that, in some part, is true. Adolescence is a time of significant development, so with dramatic kind of bodily changes, teens experience more intense emotions and emotional shifts, and very importantly, the self is actually being reorganized in the context of more peer-directed norms and interactions, and there's a pressure toward autonomy and assuming adult roles. also, it's true that a lot of the behaviors that characterize BPD in adolescents, including self-harm, substance use, and risky sexual behavior, commonly do occur in typical adolescents. Although, rather than this being evidence that BPD is being confused with typical problems of adolescence, it really is only a part of a larger picture of development in which the foundations of BPD are being set in childhood and adolescence. So our models of BPD development state that there's an interplay between constitutional or temperamental factors and environmental factors that transact over time, and individuals actually play a very active role in this transaction. Also, the period of adolescence that is marked by significant change is actually a sensitive phase for the development of BPD. So it's due to all these changes, people are at significantly higher risk for developing BPD during this age range. And also that BPD actually can be distinguished from the adolescent crises that are not necessarily associated with mental problems. So the first symptoms or signs of BPD can be detected at actually a pretty early age. There was one large study in England that found that 3.2% of 11-year-olds met diagnostic criteria for BPD, and that's not too far off from the 5.9% of adults who met criteria. And that cohort of 11-year-olds even presented with some of the core diagnostic criteria of BPD, which includes chronic emptiness, self-harm, and stormy relationships. And interestingly, there do seem to be differences in how BPD presents between adolescence and adulthood. So in that study that was conducted in the UK, the 11-year-olds tended to be more reactive and have interpersonal problems, which included abandonment fears, but the adults were more likely to have paranoia or dissociation, serious identity disturbance, impulsivity, and efforts to avoid abandonment. Another study that my mentor, Carlo Sharp, conducted found that different symptoms of BPD actually differentially discriminate between adults and youth with BPD. So similar to this UK study, her findings showed differences between age groups in terms of just the relative endorsement of different BPD criteria. But what was really interesting in this study is that she found that for interpersonal criteria, so that would be emptiness and identity disturbance, that are more prevalent among adults, they actually seem to have better discriminatory properties among teens. And so while these criteria may be endorsed less and harder to recognize among teens, they may be more central to the BPD diagnosis. So what that means is that a teenager who has identity disturbance is probably more likely to have a BPD diagnosis compared to a teenager who meets the affective instability criteria of BPD. So going back to that study I was talking about before by Christopher Conway, it's possible that these interpersonal criteria, such as identity and emptiness and interpersonal kind of paranoia, those may be more representative of the stable trait-like part of BPD, whereas the more behavioral criteria like self-harm or impulsivity could be more transient responses to environmental stressors that are actually more prevalent during adolescence. So again, this research really needs replication, but it's really interesting to think about how we can understand the different criteria of BPD and how it may actually provide information about the stability of the disorder in any given individual. So despite the differences in how the disorder may present across time or age, there are suggestions that the prevalence of BPD is actually similar between adults and teens. Similarly, the stability of BPD is also pretty similar across adolescence and adulthood. So in community samples, prevalence ranges from 6 to 17%. It's probably a little bit closer to the lower end of that range. And then clinical samples have found a prevalence range from between 41% to 64%. And that number is actually slightly higher in juvenile justice samples. So that, I think, ranges up to like 80% in juvenile justice samples. So one aspect of validity evidence for BPD in teens is based on evidence of the long-term outcomes of adolescents with BPD. And so that includes problems in the areas of education and eventually work, also interpersonal relationships, and then other mental health problems. So the children in the community sample, which is a large population sample collected in New York, that included multiple follow-up time points, they found that 83% of adolescents who met BPD criteria had some sort of adverse outcomes in early adulthood. It's a pretty high number. Also, about 59% of them would meet criteria for another psychiatric disorder in adulthood. 37% reported numerous difficulties in interpersonal relationships. 24% had school failures of some sort. 42% reported being seriously physically aggressive to another person. And about 25% had attempted suicide. Also, in that sample, those with BPD were more likely to require mental health services later on in life. Similarly, there have been studies that were conducted in Australia that found that among 15 to 25-year-olds who met diagnostic criteria for BPD, the annual cost of reduced employment was about $475 million, and that BPD was the fourth leading cause of disability-adjusted life years in females. And even when looking at physical health outcomes, BPD has been associated with greater cardiovascular disease in young adults and also greater substance use and unsafe sex. So altogether, there's really a lot of kind of psychosocial negative outcomes for people who are meeting criteria for BPD in adolescence. So it really points to the long-term negative outcomes of this just presenting in adolescence. And then speaking to the comorbidity of BPD with other mental health problems, a study that was conducted here in Houston with inpatient teens found that adolescents with BPD had extensive comorbidity. So 56.9% of teens with BPD in the study met criteria for complex comorbidity, which is defined as comorbidity of both internalizing and externalizing disorders. And that was significantly higher than the rates found in other teens, inpatient teens who didn't have BPD. So these are still pretty severe teens, but the comorbidity is still not quite as severe as it is for BPD. So it seems that the effect of having BPD symptoms is that kind of the typical maturation and socialization processes can be disrupted. And that process is actually bidirectional. So BPD symptoms increase and are increased by poor life adaptation. And that can in turn generate and be actually worsened by other types of mental disorders. So what that means is that characteristics of BPD could actually generate a negative bidirectional interaction between a person and their environment. And when that happens, the supportive and kind of resilience-enhancing properties of the social environment are negated, and that leaves an individual more vulnerable to both social and biological risk. And so even after somebody may technically remit from the disorder, so that, again, means just meeting less than five diagnostic criteria, there still could be very severe psychosocial impairments for decades after. In fact, there have been studies that were published that show social functioning impairment remained 2 years after remission. Another study, or two studies that were based on the same sample, found that there were enduring psychosocial impairments both 10 and 16 years after that technical remission point. So it's possible that even when the main kind of crisis, besides the core aspects of personality pathology persists. And this actually may increase the likelihood that BPD symptoms could be re-exacerbated. It's well known that poor social, school, and health functioning are detrimental to mental health. So feeling connected to school and participating in extracurricular activities both predict fewer mental health problems as well as risky sexual and substance use behaviors. And so just in general, even though people may not be meeting diagnostic criteria, they still are at pretty high risk for experiencing problems later in life. So when speaking to this transactional dynamic, it's been highlighted in several studies that have come out of the Pittsburgh Girl Study, which is a longitudinal study of high-risk families in Pittsburgh, which I mentioned earlier, and for one study that was published from this sample, Aiden Wright published a study that in which he found that borderline symptoms co-developed with psychosocial dysfunction across adolescence. So basically increasing borderline symptoms were coupled with worsening social, academic, and mental health outcomes, whereas amelioration of BPD symptoms were associated with gains in functioning across these domains. And this also when controlling for the presence of other types of disorders, the specific developmental associations of BPD were with social skills, perception of self, and sexual activity. So this is really important because self and interpersonal development are key tasks of adolescence, and if they're disrupted, an individual may actually fail to kind of cultivate these skills later in life, and then, again, more severe impairments are more likely later in life. Also, a couple of studies published by this group kind of highlight the transactional nature between borderline symptoms and an adolescent's immediate environment. So in one study, they found that children who were more emotionally reactive actually experienced more insensitive parenting. That would include more harsh punishment and more warmth. And this kind of dynamic then further predicted more symptoms of BPD 1 year later. So again, this is a kind of bi-directional relationship in which child temperament predicts kind of reactions in parenting, which then further exacerbates the BPD symptoms. And so that really points to the bidirectionality of influence between parents and children, which is really hallmark to the Family Connections program. And there seem to be kind of certain characteristics of families that play off or exacerbate each other so that when not intervened on, it can actually lead to some snowballing effects in which children's symptoms are worsened and family relationships are damaged. So speaking specifically to family relationships, there's a lot of literature that seems to kind of blame the parents, pointing to associations over time between like warmth and rejection, parental satisfaction or hostility, and increased BPD symptoms among children. However, there was a recent study by Michael Hallquist that kind of added some specificity to those previously published findings. And again, it really points to the bidirectional nature between parents and children and the development of BPD. They found that while maladaptive parenting was associated with level of BPD symptoms at age 14, the actual increase in BPD symptoms across adolescents, so that would be from age 14 to 17, were only predicted by children's self-control abilities in pre-adolescence. So the only unique predictor of BPD symptom increases was child's own self-control. So these early problems in self-control, which is can be thought of as emotion regulation or some component of emotion regulation, actually predicted more harsh punishment between ages 10 to 14, which again reciprocally led to more difficulties in self-control among children. So really notable is that these patterns were only found when looking at child reports of parenting behavior and not in parent reports of their own behavior. So that really suggests that it's the child's perception of parenting that seems to kind of show significance here. And we all know that emotional sensitivity kind of creates a lens by which people interpret their environment. So therefore, even parenting behaviors that could be harmless or normal to an average teenager could be perceived as insensitive by someone with a more vulnerable temperament. And so it's really the interaction between a child's temperament and early behavior and the parents' responses that could lead to this kind of troubling feedback loop in which children who may kind of respond to parental requests with either intense negative emotions or with defiance are more likely to elicit negative emotions and demands for compliance by their parents. And this will only kind of lead to increases in disruptive behavior and noncompliance. So it's also possible that if that cycle is enduring and kind of problematic enough, children can bring those interpersonal dynamics into their own sphere of relationships between themselves and peers or romantic partners, which again has a similar feedback loop and possibly could lead to more interpersonal dysfunction and distress. So there are a few kind of important takeaways from this research that really emphasize the importance of early intervention and diagnosis of BPD in teens. So first, what these studies, along with other studies, suggest is there really is a sensitive period during adolescence for the development of BPD. So self-control, as I mentioned before, which is an aspect of emotion regulation, it really increases most rapidly during adolescence, corresponding to puberty. We also know that social cognition and the sense of self undergo transition during this age. As I mentioned earlier, that's partly due to brain development that is somewhat unbalanced in terms of the emotional versus kind of more behavioral control centers of the brain. So the frontal cortex, which plays a central role in regulating behavior and emotions and planning, develops kind of last and later than our emotion centers like the amygdala, so that during adolescence, emotions feel more salient and they seem to have more behavioral consequences as the frontal cortex is kind of catching up. So also during this time, adolescents are much more aware and sensitive to the perceptions of themselves and how they believe others perceive them. So we often see a dip in self-esteem and increases in self-consciousness during adolescence, and that's kind of a result of those changes. So kind of amidst other kinds of adverse environments or extreme situational factors, adolescents are at increased risk for developing BPD, which can be characterized by kind of severe deficits in interpersonal functioning and emotion regulation. So the second point, which really cannot be understated, is that we desperately need to intervene at an early age while personality is still developing and people are most sensitive to environmental changes. So the concern that a diagnosis of BPD may be stigmatizing and harmful for a young person, I think, does not justify the negative effects of denying an individual and their family the necessary information that they may need to receive adequate care. In fact, there was a recent study that looked at adolescent patients' experiences of being diagnosed with BPD. So they found that in general, patients seemed to understand the construct of BPD. They did feel that the diagnosis was an accurate reflection of their difficulties, and it did help them understand their symptoms. So in general, patients also didn't notice a change in how clinicians treated them after their diagnosis was made, but it's not clear whether that is because these teens happened to be working with mental health professionals who had more experience and knowledge about BPD in adolescence. Also, another study that was conducted by Stephanie Stepp and her colleagues actually did an observation of mothers interacting with their 16-year-old daughters, and these particular girls were selected because they had difficulties in emotion regulation, so they kind of sampled a more emotionally reactive sample. And so they measured BPD symptoms in daughters between the ages 16 and 18, and they found that maternal support and validation that they observed in those interactions actually predicted decreases in BPD symptoms across late adolescence. So that really shows that among more emotionally vulnerable teens, there are factors that could protect teens from going on to develop BPD later in life. So this point is really emphasized in Andrew Channon's work that I alluded to earlier. So he identified that kind of late intervention of BPD might actually be the norm currently in practice. And so that would just be intervening kind of after somebody has been meeting full diagnostic criteria for a while. And at that stage of the disorder, it's more likely that individuals are kind of more functionally impaired, and they may have also had poor experiences in the mental health system, and subsequently interventions will be less effective. In one meta-analysis of treatment effectiveness, they found that across a range of studies that looked at outcomes of evidence-based treatments for BPD, effect sizes were only really moderate. So it seems like we seem to be missing the boat in some way. Andrew Channon has also spoken about other adverse effects of delaying a diagnosis of BPD, and that includes increased likelihood of kind of inappropriate or harmful intervention, which could be kind of multiple medication prescriptions. Also, he has discussed the way that our current healthcare system is set up could be extremely ineffective for BPD because it focuses more on these acute symptoms like self-harm or hospitalization as opposed to the more enduring symptoms I talked about earlier. Also, evidence-based treatments like DPT are incredibly expensive and not very easily found. So the GAP initiative is therefore working to promote both prevention and early intervention that is less focused on kind of a full-blown diagnosis of BPD, but rather on risk factors that predict the persistence or deterioration over time. So the clinical staging model is an especially useful way of carrying out this because it identifies treatments that are most effective for different stages of the disorder. So, for example, you could utilize more benign treatments at earlier stages of a disorder, and that could more effectively prevent a disorder from reaching the more severe stages. So what needs to happen for this to move forward is an identification of salient risk factors that could predict the course of BPD rather than specific acute symptoms of BPD, and then develop and provide services for people who may have those risk factors even though they may not actually have the diagnosis. So to that end, Stephanie Sepp recently published a review paper of studies that were conducted using longitudinal design. And so these studies could kind of uniquely speak to risk factors that are predictive of persistence or worsening of BPD symptoms over time, rather than maybe predicting BPD at any given time point, which we know now is may not be predictive of the longitudinal course or prognosis of BPD. So her review supported multiple factors across social, family, maltreatment, and child domains. The most robust risk factors that she found were low SES, stressful life events, and family adversity in the social domain. In the family domain, she found maternal psychopathology, low affective parenting, so that includes low warmth, hostility, and harsh punishment. She also found exposure to physical or sexual abuse or neglect in the maltreatment domain. And then in the child domain, she found that low IQ, high negative affect, impulsivity, and then internalizing and externalizing symptoms were also salient. So while that review paper kind of marks a significant level of understanding, largely from work that was only conducted in the last like decade or two, not all of these studies investigated the more nuanced risk processes, like the one I talked about with parenting and child temperament. And so, again, these need to be replicated. But it does provide an important start to understanding risk factors that may mark, even in the absence of BPD symptoms or full diagnosis, youth who could benefit from follow-up assessments and then preventions. Also, more recently, a study identified groups of adolescents based on their trajectory of symptoms. So they found three groups. One group was characterized by having high levels or increasing symptoms over time. Another group that had kind of intermediate levels of symptoms that were stable over time. And then lastly, they had a group that had just low levels of symptoms that were stable and low. So this study found that there were unique risk factors that predicted group membership. So that included mental health problems like ADHD symptoms and actually somatization, which is somewhat new. They also found problematic peer relationships predicted group status and reactive temperament. So this study also supports the idea that there are different trajectories for youth who have symptoms of BPD, and it's really important to identify those more unique risk factors that may put youth on a specific trajectory. So based on that small but growing body of research, the GAP Initiative has identified research priorities, which include developing prevention and early intervention for BPD, and that those programs be kind of integrated with efforts for other disorders. So it's likely that there are similar risk factors that put youth at risk for a range of disorders, and we currently don't have a lot of information about what puts kids with this kind of broad risk on a trajectory toward BPD in particular compared to other serious mental illnesses. But in terms of looking at prevention and early intervention, this could be applied kind of broadly to people who exhibit that kind of broad risk. They also advocate for providing information that can help our healthcare system start to include the prevention and earlier intervention treatments, and that those are based on causal mechanisms underlying risk rather than acute symptoms. Also, just for including this clinical staging model rather than broad-based interventions, and also to promote education and skill development programs for families with children who have BPD or BPD symptoms, similar to family connections, actually. And then to also develop and validate brief and user-friendly assessment tools that could promote more systematic screening across multiple settings. And then just to measure health economic data and to identify methods that may improve access to evidence-based treatments. So kind of coming back to my original point of whether BPD can be diagnosed in adolescence, I just want to reiterate a few points. So BPD can be diagnosed as reliable and valid in adolescence as an adult, and the prevalence of BPD kind of peaks in early adolescence and then declines. And by late adolescence, the prevalence is really comparable to prevalence in adults. There are between 41 to 64% of adolescents in clinical settings meeting diagnostic criteria for BPD, so that suggests that they're highly prevalent in these more severe samples. Personality disorder changes from childhood through adulthood in a similar way to normal range personality. So we see kind of increases through adolescence that kind of decrease through adulthood, and that the stability of personality disorder is actually moderate. The functional impairments associated with BPD are stable across time, even after an actual diagnosis remits, and that there's often co-occurrence with other mental disorders, and that co-occurrence and comorbidity actually leads to poor prognosis. Okay, so coming full circle, although now we know that diagnosing BPD during adolescence is feasible, this doesn't come without its own limitations. So while clinicians who may, well-meaning clinicians may purposely refrain from using a BPD diagnosis with their adolescent patients, they do so to avoid stigma. They may actually unintentionally reinforce that very stigma they're trying to avoid. So there's also the possibility that the pendulum may swing in the other direction. So with the removal of age limits from diagnostic categories, that could lead to even more young people being diagnosed with EPD, even when they may not meet full criteria. So it's always important to weigh the benefits of a diagnosis with the risks and to make sure that diagnoses are made responsibly via comprehensive assessment and that attention is paid to the persistence of these characteristics. So knowing that persistence is associated with worse outcomes and higher likelihood of the disorder later in life. So that is all I have, and I just wanted to leave some time for questions or if I can clarify anything that I mentioned earlier.
Oh, Salome, that was wonderful. What a hopeful conversation and very emotional. If you have any questions, somebody, go ahead, go open for questions.
Hi, Salome. This is Matt Costello. I have actually three questions, and to echo what Ann said, it's just tremendous information. The first one is there's so much information there that leaders could actually use when they get questions about this. I'm wondering, would you have slides to share that you could send to me, and I'll get them on our website? Would that be possible?
Yeah. Well, I don't have any slides from today, but I can pull slides from other similar talks that can have the same kind of takeaway information.
Terrific. Yes, send it to me. I can contact you offline, but our email address is, I think you have it or Karen has it, is fcwhiteplains@gmail.com. But I'll write you separately, and we'll get them on our website because I think people can refer to the data. It'd be so important. So the second thing is for people out there who are dealing day-to-day with therapists and the situations with, you know, and we get that in our class a lot, through the efforts of GAP, is progress being made in terms of the awareness growing that, yes, we can intervene and we can do something in an early age? In other words, is the news getting out there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're currently working on developing curriculum that can be kind of disseminated to different educational programs. And so they're starting within like graduate programs to have some sort of common curriculum that does that can be used with trainees. I think there's still probably a lot of work that can be done with people who are currently in practice, but there has been a peak kind of in the research that's been disseminated. So there is kind of in current conferences and stuff that this information is being disseminated, but it's still in the very early stages.
And sorry for asking one more question. I have one more question, so I want to ask it. And again, we've told people who have showed up in our class, we've had ages as young as 10 or 14 and 13, that we say, because a lot of people, their children are 35 and 40 at the same time, that there is an advantage because many of us wish we had that information, had that time machine to be back there. Would you say, I mean, it's kind of off topic from what you were talking about, but would you say that the observation that to pass that information along, that it's valuable and true?
What are you doing?
That having that early advantage can make a difference.
Yeah, it definitely is the case that just learning about some of these things that can improve, I mean, especially thinking about the early family environment that can, like validation for one, that can kind of stop that that cycle of negative transactions between parents and the children. And so just validation alone is such a crucial, crucial skill. And just having that information early can kind of, it teaches, so validating the child teaches them emotion regulation strategies and that can make a lot of difference. So I'm not aware of research that can kind of specifically point to that process. So that kind of early education and kind of intervention and just knowledge at an earlier age actually leads to improving BPD symptoms, but there is a lot of research that shows that there are these kinds of protective factors that when utilized does lessen symptoms over time.
Perfect. Thanks.
Any other questions? Comments?
Yes, it's Cindy Gertis calling from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Can you hear
Hi.
Me?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So I'm really very interested in hearing about the opportunities for intervention ahead of a formal diagnosis.
Yeah.
Our health system here in Alberta is really looking to try and grapple with some of the symptoms for people who don't have a formal diagnosis with a view, as you absolutely say, to try to prevent the development of BPD symptoms later on. I'm wondering, though, part of putting together the business case and selling this kind of intervention is to talk about what recovery from BPD looks like. So you talked about the fact that the traits may remit, or they would no longer meet the criteria for borderline personality disorder. And yet, I believe I also heard from some other studies that even in that situation, that some of the real life interfering aspects of their illness can persist for anywhere between 2 and 10 years. Is that right?
And so you're asking kind of how do we sell early intervention while we still have research that says that they still may end up having difficulties in the long run, even with intervention? So, I mean, I think that where the field is now is that it's hard to say what can't be done, given that we haven't really applied these more early, broad-based prevention efforts kind of widely. And so the research that we're looking at that shows these more long-lasting impairments are not necessarily in samples that have received early intervention. So I think that what, if we're speaking to kind of a selling point, that we should really kind of use early intervention efforts to measure the outcomes. And so these studies are mostly in just community samples that were followed up over time. And so we don't actually know much about what sort of services they received and when. But I think that I think what is helping now and what we're learning more and more about are the underlying mechanisms behind those more enduring aspects. And so we know now that for one, mentalizing or social cognition and interpersonal difficulties seem to be a core symptom of BPD that are more enduring compared to some of the other symptoms. And so now that we have that information, we can actually kind of more directly intervene. And so I think research is still so young in that regard that it's hard to say that what may or may not be effective. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that what we know now doesn't necessarily preclude the effectiveness of early intervention or prevention efforts. But we also don't know how effective it could be. So sorry if that's...
Right. No, that makes good sense to me. And as you said, the current emphasis is getting to remission of some of those really very dangerous kinds of impulsivity, self-harm, substance abuse, high sexual activity, and those traits seem to remit with treatment, for sure. So these other kinds of things that are more enduring, I'm curious about in terms of, and this is perhaps just more amusing than a question, but in terms of, does it potentially rise to the level of requiring ongoing treatment, or is it more in a so-called normal range that might be managed through, community-based intervention as opposed to level 4, level 5 kind of treatment context?
Yeah, I think so. And I think part of it is could be maybe ongoing social support. And so having a system, a social system or a network that is kind of aware and supportive of those specific difficulties. And so, again, we're really looking at a more interpersonal realm. And so it, you're right, I think it doesn't necessarily need to be, you know, weekly DBT individual and group, but either something that's more infrequent check-in with a therapist, but also a support network that is maybe equipped with some of these skills that can be beneficial to somebody who has BPD or BPD features.
And, of course, they're very skilled parents and loved ones who've been to Family Connections.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And that's why Family Connections is so important and so helpful that it does kind of provide that network for people who are struggling.
Well, thank you so much, Salome. It is 5 o'clock here in New York, and you were wonderful. It will be on neabpd.com and the website. Your whole chatting talk is wonderful. So thank you, everybody, and may we have some nice warm weather soon.
Okay.
Thank you, Salome.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.